All right, we'll start the August 4th, 2022 meeting of the Development and Engineering Advisory Board. My name is Mike Ogren, interim chair until Jamie shows up. A few housekeeping items first. Well, actually, let's get through introductions. Again, Mike Ogren, Olson Engineering. Eric. Okay, good. Want to introduce yourself, Eric?
Yep. Eric Galimo, SGA Engineering.
People in the room.
April Firth, Director of Community Development.
Brent Davis, DEEB Coordinator.
Diana Nutt, Development Engineering.
Jennifer Reynolds, Development Engineering.
Noelle Levern, BIA of Clark County.
Justin Wood, Clark County Association of Realtors.
That was Byron Jolman with Jolman Design. For those of you who don't have... Brian Groth, BSG Design. Oh, there you go.
Kevin Ford from SGA Engineering.
And Kelly Schinners from SGA Engineering.
Great. Now, people online, let's start with the D members.
Terry Wallum, Wallum & Associates.
Nick Flagg, Clark Public Utilities.
Thomas Praisewater with Community Development.
If there's a break, just go ahead and introduce yourself. Everybody
Rod
online.
Swanson. Oops.
Okay,
Rod
go
Swanson,
ahead, Rod.
County Public Works.
And Oliver Ojako, Community Planning Director.
Jenna Kay, Community Planning.
Ted Venegas, Community Development.
Jason Weeks, True North Geotechnical.
Leanne Bremer, today representing the Clark County School Districts.
Okay, anybody else who hasn't introduced themselves? Great, thank you very much. Just a reminder that the D meetings are being recorded and the audio will be posted on the DEEB's website. We will defer review and approval of the minutes until if and when we have a quorum. I believe we only have one, two, three, four available, four present right now. Eric, myself, Terry, and Nick. Are there any other DEEB members that that are present that we don't know about? Hearing none, we'll move on. We'll review the upcoming events, and that looks like that's either you or Jennifer. That's you. Okay.
Yes. Not a whole lot upcoming. Council has a hearing on August 16th on the Aging Readiness Plan Update Public Participation Plan. It's a mouthful. No work session scheduled for the upcoming month so far. Planning Commission is having a work session tonight on the school capital facility plan updates that you're hearing about today, and they will be having a hearing on that on August 18th at 6:30 p.m. In addition to that, in terms of the vacant board member position, I have made a recommendation to the county manager. We have not had that finalized yet. I asked for an update earlier this week and have not had a response.
Very good, thank you. Any member announcements? Seeing none, I do. We recently had the second public hearing with County Council regarding the interim ordinance for the Shared Outdoor Recreation Plan. And I'd just like to say thank you to Ted and April for attending and participating in that and giving a good background, answering questions that the council had, and it resulted in the interim ordinance passing, and sounds like that will be moving on to hopefully becoming a permanent code once staff gets around into doing that. So again, thank you for being there.
I do have an update to that. A referendum was applied for the interim ordinance.
What does that mean?
the public filed a referendum. So we have to look more into what that means.
What does that mean now for current in-process projects?
I believe they're on hold.
Can you file a referendum on anything that council does? That's a good way to just stop anything you don't like. I mean, it doesn't really, I'm not sure what that process is, but.
We're working through that process right now, and I will update.
Okay.
Jamie might know more.
Yeah.
Yeah, please do let us know once you have a clear understanding as far as what that means, because it's apparently the public isn't getting the full picture, or we didn't give a good story as to why it was that we needed to do this. So sounds like there's more work ahead. And I do know that I do have a project that's currently in design right now that if the interim ordinance does not move forward, it will not meet the separate on a 9-acre site, which nets out about 7.5 acres with right-of-way dedication. We still need over an acre of the shared recreational outdoor space. And that's going to be challenging at best. And again, I think it's important to recognize and remember that should this interim ordinance not go forward, or if a referendum were successful, that the county could not be in compliance with the comprehensive plan and would not be able to meet their density goals. So, okay. And there is going to be one other item I know that Jamie talked about putting on the agenda today, and we'll see where we get. We'll go ahead and put it at the end of the agenda, and that will be the shoreline exemption and boundary line adjustment issue that's come up on several occasions for at least an initial discussion today, and probably further discussion at future meetings. If there are no other member announcements, we'll go ahead and move on to the second item on the agenda, and that will be the 2022 school capital facility plan and impact fee updates. And I guess Jenna and Leanne will be presenting that. Take it away.
Thank you. One moment while I pull up slides. Sorry. Okay. Sorry. I don't know what is going on. I'm going to not leave it there. Okay. Can you all see slides?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. So good afternoon. My name is Jenna Kay with Community Planning, and I'm joined today by Leanne Bremer, who is representing 6 school districts who have school capital facility plan and impact fee updates with hearings before the Planning Commission on August 18th at 6:30 p.m. So I'm going to just provide a brief update and overview on these, and then Leanne and I are here and available to answer any questions that you may have. So, you know, why does the county even look at school district capital facility plans and impact fee updates? Well, the Growth Management Act enables school districts to develop capital facility plans and impact fee programs for new residential developments in order to offset the impacts of growth on school facilities. So it further requires these plans and programs be reviewed and approved as part of the county and city comprehensive plans in which the school district is located. So that's why the county reviews these types of requests for all school districts within Clark County. The minimum requirements of a school district's capital facilities plan, or CFP, are defined in the Growth Management Act and Clark County Code. And basically, a school district requesting impact fees needs to submit to the county and update at least every 4 years, a capital facilities plan adopted by the school board, and it has to include the following elements: a standard of service description, an inventory of existing facilities, a forecast of future needs, proposed locations and capacities of expanded or new facilities, and then a 6-year financing plan and application of the impact fee formula that's set out in county code. As you may know, school district CFPs typically include multiple funding sources. So depending on district eligibility, districts pay for a portion of the costs of their capital facility needs with funds from the state of Washington through the Common School Construction Fund. But the remaining capital expenses need to be raised locally, and that's either through the passage of bond levies, which, if approved by voters, raise property taxes on all residential property owners within a particular district, and or through impact fees, which only apply to new residential construction within the district. The school impact fee formula in county code determines the maximum impact fee amount a school district can request. So this table summarizes the impact fee amounts for each school district that has an updated CFP this year. And you can see the existing fee and the proposed fee for single family and multifamily dwellings. And then on the right-hand side of the table is the calculated difference and percent change between the current and proposed fee amounts. So you may notice there's a wide range in the proposed fee amounts for, you know, across the districts. And if you look at each district's capital facilities plan, you know, that's really where you'll find the background information and context behind these numbers. So I've just got a few more things to say, but I'll leave the slide up so you can look at it some more. So staff reviews each school district's capital facilities plan and the associated impact fees for consistency with the Growth Management Act, the county's comprehensive plan, and Clark County Code. And the staff report for each district walks through all the applicable criteria, evaluation, and findings. So in staff's review, we found that all six of the proposed CFP updates and impact fee requests are consistent with the criteria we have to evaluate them against. If you're interested in looking at the actual CFPs for any of the districts or the staff reports, they are all currently posted on the Planning Commission's webpage. As mentioned earlier, the Planning Commission hearings for all six of these districts is scheduled for August 18th at 6:30 p.m. You are welcome to submit comments ahead of time in writing, or you can attend the meeting to testify. The meeting is hybrid, so if you want to join remotely, those details on how to do so are posted on the Planning Commission webpage as well. So that's all I have, and Leanne and I are glad to answer any questions if you have any. Thanks.
Thank you, Jenna. How often is this updated?
Yeah, the school districts have to update their plans every 4 years. So not all the school districts are on the exact same schedule, which is why you only see six of them here that are going through this update now. And I will also add, there has been a delay because of COVID. So these districts were scheduled, I think it was about 2 years ago, to be updated, but requested extensions from the council to delay these updates until now.
So can you give us some insight as to, I see some changes here, 3% up, 4%, or 3% down, 4% up. You know, Washougal goes away altogether for some reason. I don't know. What's that all about?
So I can jump in here. This is Leanne Bremer. So there are 9 school districts in Clark County, and 6 are up for these plan updates, as you know. And for all of them being in Clark County, they're all remarkably unique. Some are rural, some are mostly urban, some are a combination of both. And there are so many variables that get plugged into the impact fee formula that yields different results depending on what you plug in, and it has to do with their existing facilities, if they have any capacity today. If they don't, it has to do with enrollment projections. Some are growing faster than others. Some are not growing at all, like Washougal and Green Mountain, which may be counterintuitive in Washougal, but they had a professional demographer look at that, and they also have capacity. So they don't have the need in the next 6 years to build a new facility to respond to growth. So that's why you see zero there. So it's and then it's also a function of whether they can pass bonds or not. You know, Ridgefield has unfortunately been unable to pass their bond the last couple times out, and they are severely over capacity. And but they need facilities to serve the growth that's happening out there. So it's just, I would say there's probably 10 or 12 variables that get plugged into the formula, and it's all unique to each district.
So it appears that, yes, thank you, Leanne, appreciate it. So with some of these other Battleground, Camas, Ridgefield, all three of the largest and fastest growing communities in Clark County, have significant increases. And you mentioned that that might be partly attributable to the fact that other sources of funding are unavailable, such as being able to pass a bond. And if that's the case, if bonds were able to be passed, would the percentage increase of these be lower?
Yeah, I don't know if I would say that the fee is dependent on the, we have to have other sources of funding for a new school. It can't be built totally with impact fees. The lack of bonds being passed, just what that results in is overcapacity and the need for new facilities. Which so where why you get a high number in Ridgefield is because they need to build so much to accommodate the growth. So the cost of the new facilities that gets plugged into the formula is really driving that number, as opposed to maybe a Vancouver who is growing, but has some capacity. They don't need as much. They don't need as many facilities at a high cost. So that's really what's driving the numbers primarily. Not we do need public funding for all these facilities in order to collect impact fees.
So what I'm hearing is that even whether bond measures had passed or not, we would still be looking generally at the same numbers.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. I just want to make sure that if bond measures aren't passing, that they're not then totally relying on impact fees to be able to fund their facilities.
No, and they
which
they
in turn
can't.
Gets passed on to
right
the consumer essentially.
Right.
Okay. And I would just add, having reviewed these, I think all three of those districts, and Leanne, correct me if I'm wrong, you know, have their financing plan includes a bond passing.
Yes.
So, it's not like, so they are counting on being able to pass a bond to cover a really big portion of the expenses. So
that's correct.
That is part, that's part of their whole financing plan.
Right. Thank you. Any other D members have any other questions for Jen or Leanne? Hearing none, I would assume that this is for information only, that you're not looking for recommendation or anything from us, because I don't think we can give it.
That's right. But you are welcome, you know, to participate in the Planning Commission hearing if you'd like, if you would like to submit comments either as a group or individually.
Okay. Not seeing or hearing any other comments from any D members. Thank you for your time today. Appreciate the update.
You bet.
Thank you.
Have there been any other D members that have logged in online? I know Nick and Terry are on there, but
Dan Weiss.
Let the record show that Andrew's here. What was that, Terry?
Dan Weissner has called in. He wasn't able to join through the link.
Okay, so Dan is on.
I am on.
He is.
Yep.
Okay, great. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Hey, we have a quorum. Okay, very good. yes, I think I'll do that. I'm going to go up back to the administrative actions and go to review and adopt the minutes from last month. Before we do that, though, I do have a couple of edits to be made to that before they are finalized. The second page, WDFW update, It's just, these are Scrivener's errors, misspellings. A regional is misspelled. On the third page, the E-plan update that Jennifer gave, second bullet from the bottom, phase is misspelled. I think it should be P-H-A-S-E. The last page, first bullet at the top, I think it's supposed to say the original report said that we had 1,615 acres of excess land instead of access land. Real nitpicky, but want to make sure that our minutes are accurate. And then 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth bullet down, Jeff Riston's name is spelled incorrectly. And as long as people have that, I would take a motion to approve.
So moved.
So moved. Do we have a second?
I'll second.
Okay, we have a motion and second. All in favor, say aye.
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 Okay, sounds like that's everybody. I will abstain, so they are, because I wasn't here. So those minutes are moved or approved. All right, moving back on. Next, we will move on to the single family stormwater plan review with Jennifer and Eric. Go for it.
Jennifer, you want to open or do you have a microphone? Okay. Okay. So we put this on the agenda. This is
just a moment. Can everybody hear Eric okay out there in virtual land?
I'll move the mic a little closer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I can hear Eric well.
Okay. Sounds good. And what we could also do, I know there's some guests that are here for this one. We might like move some of these microphones that are not being used out there. So if someone wants to chime in, there's one for every like two people or something. So there's a lot of history on these stormwater plans. It's gone through over the years since they started requiring these for especially for stormwater plans and additional permitting for rural tax lots mostly, or anything that's not in a subdivision with an approved stormwater plan. I can count four different times that this has come up, and some of them were significant. So there was the functional oversight committee that met about probably four or five times with a group of maybe 30 people. Brent, you were part of that.
Yeah.
And that came out of the Citygate report. There was another group. There was an SFR work group from DEEB that was formed. There was the project delivery stakeholder group. And then there's just been a few over the years. And every time we meet on this, the conclusion basically is we need to find a simple, streamlined way to handle these permits because, before a certain date, they didn't even require stormwater plans. They were considered low risk. There wasn't any stormwater required. Now, with the new Department of Ecology requirements, there is requirements to do stormwater on anything that has over a certain number of square footage of new impervious surface or disturbed acreage. So it throws these into a different type of review than we had before. So the challenge has always been, how do we do some type of review that meets the requirements of Department of Ecology while not being so cumbersome on a very small project? Basically, try to find a review process that's proportional to the risk. And also try to find a way to do that effectively. And just kind of one example is when you look at doing a stormwater report for like a large development or a subdivision, apartment complex, something like that, you're probably effort and the plans and the reports, they start at $20,000 to $30,000 to do one of those stormwater reports and the stormwater design for a large project like that. For a single family home, you're looking at a much, much lower fee. And a lot of times you're dealing with a much less sophisticated applicant as well within the home builder. So you don't have as sophisticated of an applicant and you're trying to do it for less money and you're trying to do it something that's proportional to the impact and the size of the project. So we came through, that's basically been the outcome of all of these different committees. And over the years, I think that institutional knowledge has kind of got lost. I think, every time it changes over with new staff or a new reviewer, or even a lot of times when it was done by a third-party reviewer, that new reviewer had to be kind of brought up to speed on what the level of detail required to review something like that. So that's pretty much how it is, and I think it's kind of gone recently where maybe it's just a reminder. And I think, and I want to like say that it's gone back to what it was, but I think we can do it better. And that's really kind of why we're here. I feel like there's something we can do as a group to be on the same page, to come up with and this was kind of the objective of the last time Max Booth is here. He's online here. He was kind of leading one of the last efforts on these stormwater plans. And the objective was to create a simplified checklist, cursory review level to show competency in the provided design to avoid labor-intensive review for small SFR stormwater projects. If it meets that level and is prepared by a licensed engineer, it can be assumed to be adequate. The level of review should be proportional to the associated risk, which is less for single-family residences. So that was kind of the goal, and we came up with this kind of checklist. It was kind of cut back originally to minimum requirements 1 through 5, but from like working on these, from the guys in our office, there's really very little difference with the level of detail required on a 1 through 5 and a 1 through 9. The reports are about the same. The risk is about the same. It can be that, you know, someone put in a patio or a little bit longer driveway. It's really the same design that we're moving forward with. So it's the same process. So I guess the challenge is, can we find a better way to do it? And do we need to go back to the drawing board? Do we need to form another subcommittee to look at it? I'd rather just kind of come up with kind of an agreement between staff and the community that does them on what is actually required, what does the county need, and how do we do it the best way possible? So that's my introduction. I just kind of open it up. I don't do these personally. Our office does a few. I've got a few of my guys from our office that work on them here. And I think there's a few other people out here that do quite a few of these, and there's a few more online. So, I want to be very careful. I want to make sure this is not a complaint session. I want this to be constructive. I want to make sure that everything we come up with is something that's going to, you know, that we are respectful, and we want to make sure that we come up with a better solution. So, and I will.
I definitely hear you, and I was part of the end of that, being in the permit center. It has recently moved to development engineering, and it was so the process was more streamlined because we also see the similarities between 1 through 9 and 1 through 5. If we want to form a subcommittee, I would like to give it a little bit of time in development engineering and let them get the process figured out before we were to do that. That would be my recommendation.
Jennifer?
I would really, I guess, like to hear from others, what others have to say about kind of, I guess, how it's been going for the last 3 months. April did mention that it was moved to development engineering, so I think, and that was starting June 1st, so we have, you know, been reviewing those solely in our department and with one reviewer primarily doing all the reviews. So I'd like to hear maybe those who've submitted in the last couple of months, if they have any comments to make about how they feel the review process is going and what kind of issues that they're seeing, and maybe what they saw at the very beginning with the first projects they submitted versus maybe the later ones that they've submitted.
Maybe just to open up to the floor, can you raise your hand if you would like to say something about the process and you're here for this item? So we make sure we can cover everybody. Okay, so kind of the back row back there. Maybe we'll start over on this side and we'll kind of work this way, and then we'll hit on the people online. And I think there's a few there as well. And we'll try to give everyone like a chance to kind of just give some quick feedback.
Yeah, so my name is Byron Jolma with Jolma Design, and yeah, we do several or a lot of these smaller residential projects. And first and foremost, just overall, the experience has been very positive with staff. We're very appreciative. They're very good about providing feedback. And so that's kind of the overarching. But I do think there's a lot of room for improvement and streamlining. I thought, Eric, you encapsulated everything that I think kind of buckets everything together there. There's a vision of where that improvement is needed. And it just has to do with primarily the scale of the project. But I think that the things for us, the two things are consistency, and then this is maybe more of a cultural thing, is just looking for a reason instead of, my impression for the most part is that staff tends to look for a reason to say no instead of a reason to say yes. So if there's a, for example, we just ran into a situation, and Jennifer and I had correspondence regarding an issue where the code was somewhat silent on, in this case, it was these calves facilities, which are very effective. They're very cost effective. They're, in my opinion, from a functional standpoint, very effective. And the code is somewhat silent on some of the design requirements. Well, so instead of making an interpretation where it's going to make it more difficult, in my opinion, to utilize what is a very effective BMP, why don't you make an interpretation that makes it easier for the homeowners? And overall, in my opinion, in this case, the risk was very, very low. Like we weren't dealing with a big stormwater pond. There wasn't a, I think that's, if, and again, I know you'd mentioned not being a complaint session. I don't want to make it that, but if we can just have a collaboration where maybe we, you know, and I understand that the staff has a responsibility to cover and comply with ecology's code, but boy, if we're making those interpretations internally and they're tending to favor, or be more of a, more stringent, I just would like there to be more of a process to where those decisions are made instead of just, amongst a couple folks, and because it can have a significant impact. I'll let some of the others speak now. I could probably ramble on for a while, but again, I want to reinforce that overall we have a great rapport. We have a ton of respect for what the staff is. They have a thankless job, and we don't want to lose sight of that. But and this is a great first step, is the fact that you're reaching out and soliciting this feedback, and I sure appreciate it.
Brian Groth, BSG Design. I want to second what Byron just said about the staff and everything. I don't want this to be a complaint session, of course, either. I think staff is doing the best that they can with being overwhelmed with all the projects. I do like the reviews and the communication process better now that it's switched from the permit center to the engineering staff. I have their direct lines. I can call them right away, email them, get fast answers. Not to say one, you know, is better than the other. I mean, the engineering staff has a little bit more flexibility to be able to talk and communicate versus the permit center. Everything's, you know, so time crunched and you only got so much time to spend on it. Consistency, again, has come up. I'll submit a stormwater plan to one reviewer and get very detailed comments, legit comments. Then I'll submit it to another reviewer or have another review, you know, submit another project, have another reviewer review it. And it's night and day difference as far as the technical review aspect of it. I've got the this other reviewer over here allowing things to go through where the other reviewer would not. And so it's like flipping a coin. When I'm doing a project, am I guessing, throwing a dart, trying to figure out which reviewer I'm going to get and design the package to that or this one? And that's kind of frustrating. And the reason the packages are different is because we're coming from the point of view where we're dealing with the builders, we're dealing with the contractors, we know cost of material, we know all this stuff. And so we're trying to make this so it's less painful for the homeowner. At the end of the day, they're the ones that are paying for all the fees. And so you get one reviewer that you've got to go by the letter, by, you know, the dot, the I, everything. Well, they're adding $5,000 to a build. Some of these builds, people maximize their loans. They can't absorb a $5,000 hit. I've had jobs downsized in houses because of the stormwater plans. And that's not right. And so you hear a lot of that out there in the public. You know, we deal with them all the time. We hear them all the time. They complain. You guys don't just hear it, you know, from the public and from us. We hear it too. And so we're constantly trying to have that discussion and say, look, it's not the staff. It's not necessarily the county. You want change in this area, you got to deal with the state. So we are also advocates for the county, for the staff, for you guys too. So we need to look at that. We need to get the reviewers that are going to do it, sit them down, get them looking at everything the same way and drawing the same conclusions when they look at it, not two different stuff. Really, I think that's about the biggest hurdle that I've got right now. As far as the detail, level of detail on the plans, we're all different. You know, some people put a ton of detail into their plans, some don't. I think we can go through the plans and look at what things that are being added and figure out what doesn't need to be there, really. Out there on the job site, does it matter the surrounding tax parcel numbers around the property, right? It's nothing. You guys think it's, you know, like the engineering reviewers think it's nothing, but it still takes us 20 minutes of time. As the CAD draft, you're sitting there figuring out which each parcel as you go into maps online and stuff like that. So you're adding time to our work for things that are to us and to the builder and the contractor and the homeowner are just frivolous things. They mean nothing. So it would be nice if we could trim down some of the things that we got to put on the plans. I think that's about all I got.
Brian, one thing to kind of add to what you said is, I don't know how you guys do it, but most of the time, there's a builder that's actually submitting the building permit. The scope of work that is on these stormwater plans is just to produce a stormwater design. It's not to do the building permit. It's not to do the site plan. It's not to do the plot plan. That's a separate permit. It's not to do the septic design. So a lot of times what I've seen come through on some of the comments are basically about the site plan, which is like done by somebody else. This is not intended to be a plot plan. It's not intended to be to show the dimensions on all this. It's basically showing a schematic design of the stormwater plan like you'd seen in a TIR, not necessarily a full site plan. The other challenge I think that came up during several of these committees is the frustration that kind of staff feels about how things don't match. As the consultants, I think we have the same frustration. We have a builder that hires a septic designer, a geotech, a storm designer, and everybody starts at the same time. And then they're given basically the concept at the time and they're working off the site plan provided by the builder. Now, the septic guy moves something, doesn't tell the engineer. We'll have situations where things won't match between these two pieces. And those are the kind of things where the county has a very important role, I think, in the review to make sure that stuff does match, because the builder is not always doing a good job making sure. We're working in a vacuum on the stormwater plan and we provide it to them. We don't know when the other pieces are coming back in. We ask for like a septic design, but if they move something, a lot of times our design is already done, gone through the process. So there's kind of understanding, I think, how it happens in the field. So if staff understands that part, it can help them actually review it and know what to actually look for when they're doing the reviews. And consistency between those designs, I think, is very important for staff to review to make sure they do match. So, and you touched on it. I wanted to kind of expand because I think there's a thought that the engineer is the one providing all that information, and they're not. So a lot of the comments, if it doesn't have to do with the stormwater design, it really shouldn't be in the stormwater review. That's a separate department, separate group.
Hi, I'm Kevin Ford from SGA. I wanted to echo what Byron and Brian were talking about. We've been facing a lot of the same things. I completely get where everybody is coming from. I really do. Everybody's trying to you know, get their thing done, and I totally get that. I've been working on these kind of plans for 4 years now. We've probably, between me and Kelly and Jace online, we've been working on hundreds of them. it is a challenge when, you know, you get one that goes through really easy and then another one that's like, whoa, this got hung up on all kinds of things. And I mean, I get it. There's all these, you know, critical areas or things that could cause issues. But when one project is, you know, five times more effort than another, it's really tough to nail down and get an accurate prediction of what it's going to be like. And so trying to, you know, I feel like Brian was saying, I'm aiming at a moving target every day. That's all I do. It's just aim at moving targets. So yeah, that consistency, I think we're all looking for that. But yeah, and we, you know, I've been looking through this Clark County SFR checklist. It's 15 pages long. That's that's what we've got here to go on. And it doesn't look that bad to me. And then, you know, we get plan reviews that go beyond this somewhat in an unexpected way. And so, so I guess my goal is to try to just figure out a way to for everybody to look at this the same way. I think part of the problem is that once you hit that 5,000 square foot project threshold, there's not much of a difference between that and a 400 lot subdivision in the stormwater code. The stormwater code does not recognize any difference. So, you know, that's what I would like to see is that recognition of that. And I think and we've got, you know, Kelly has some other things, that we've kind of touched on as well. So,
One of the things I do want to, commend the county for is at least heading down the road of consistency. I mean, we had two outside reviewers before, and so that was where you saw a huge difference of where you were getting, you know, one reviewer is doing one thing and the other is doing another thing, and sometimes they were on the same page, but sometimes they were on completely different pages. And so I do like the idea of bringing it in-house, bringing 1 through 5s and 1 through 9s, all of, you know, by the same reviewer right now, and having a little bit more level of consistency, one set of eyes, that is looking at it with the same lens. That being said, I think we've had really good success with the few 1 through 5s that we've had come back. And again, this is still early. You know, we haven't had a lot of time under this new system. But the 1 through 5s are still being done in a relatively simple review process. And I think that's been handled pretty well. But, you know, the big discrepancy we see is on the 1 through 9s. And like Kevin mentioned, that, you know, the stormwater code doesn't look at them any differently, but that doesn't mean that we have to look at them the same way. I think that we're having a separate SFR checklist for 1 through 9s, which there is, and it doesn't go into all the depth that the stormwater code necessarily would lend itself to. And so I think, you know, what I'd like to see is this checklist maybe cleaned up maybe a little bit. There's certain things that maybe could get removed or just on a case-by-case basis could be asked for. But I'd like to see this checklist something that's out to the public and not something that you have to ask for. I think that, you know, as the consultants here that we do a lot of these, it's fine. But as a consultant that, let's say, from Seattle that comes down to do one, there's nowhere on the website that necessarily leads themselves to the level that we're trying to review these under. And so their plans are going to naturally look very different if they go straight by the stormwater code than by, you know, our adopted, you know, checklist. So I think that having something like that is across the board, that we know exactly what the reviewer's looking at, consultants know exactly what to do, and then just keeping it as simple as we possibly can, again, for that level of risk to the county. You know, there's no need to add some of this extra stuff that, like you said, you know, parcel numbers around the site. It's great for the reviewer to see, but it doesn't matter down the road. You know, these plans are for the contractor to build. Most of the time we're putting all this stuff in the TIR. Contractors don't even look at the TIR. You know, why are we adding all this extra fluff to the TIR? Redundancy, you know, adding the same text multiple places when no one's even going to look at this other than the reviewer themselves. So, you know, just getting it just bare bones, you know, what is necessary to show compliance with the stormwater code and nothing else, and taking all that extra fluff away. We want these plans to be as readable as possible, and the contractor be able to build these things out in the field. If we're getting feedback that contractors aren't able to build the things, then we need to work on that rather than extra fluff to meet a stormwater code. So I think that's pretty much it on my end. So.
Great. Thank you, those in the audience here. If there's anybody calling in virtually that would also like to, again, not complain, but bring some constructive thoughts to the conversation, if you could raise your hand and just let us know who you are or something like that. We don't want y'all talking at once. Okay, Jace. Oh, Jamie. Welcome back.
Yeah, but, yeah, thank you. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Jace.
Just the one thing that occurs to me, and I'm more looking for guidance more than anything on this one, and my thoughts aren't completely composed. My understanding looking through this is that with the 1 through 5 stormwater plans, that the homeowner should be able to do them themselves. They're not required to be stamped by an engineer. The liability is lower, and that sort of question comes up a lot. And a lot of owners who are strapped for cash end up approaching me and saying, hey, can you give me a couple tips so I can go through the paperwork and do this myself? And so a question I have, I know that I've been doing these things for, you know, 4 or 5 years, but ended up with a sizable amount of comments on a 1 through 5 recently. And I'm going, if I'm immersed in this all the time, how can we help these 1 through 5 people be able to say to them, hey, this is a simple enough process. You can do it yourself. Here's a full dispersion plan. Here's how you need to show it. Because if it's an equitable review, then we're ending up in a situation where I'm sure that they get pretty frustrated going through it. So just wanted to bring that up as one other context to this.
Thank you, Jace. Anybody else? I see somebody has raised their hand, but we can't see who it is. So go ahead and start talking. Or introduce yourself and then start talking, please.
Apologies, I think I left my hand raised. I'm not
talking. Oh, okay. All right. It doesn't look like there's anybody else that wants to comment.
We can't really see if someone that called in with just a phone number. If anyone is, just go ahead and speak now.
All right, seeing and hearing none. Go ahead.
So great feedback, I think. Great comments. I think they're pretty consistent across the board. I guess kind of looking for recommendations on staff on how to move forward with it. What's the best way for you guys to do it? I know April said let's work on it in-house before we go to a subcommittee, which I fully agree with. I don't think we need it again. There's, like I said, there's been 4 subcommittees already that look at this. We have the same outcomes each time. One thing I guess I would suggest is we do have this checklist that Max and I and a few other people worked on. Going back to that and looking how we can apply that to 1 through 9s, I think is kind of the next step. The difference is the same. The impact to the public is about the same. There's really no significant difference except some of the BMPs might need a little more design expertise. And if it's being done by an engineer, then that clears that up. So you should be able to, you know, design a pond or a bioretention facility or one of the other BMPs that the general public is not qualified to do. But the amount of review, it's still proportional to the impact. So if we can find a way to come up with kind of a reviewed checklist, and I think there was a suggestion as well, having it public so we know exactly what that is. I have like, there was an, I was like looking for something else on my email the other day and I ran across what came out of the project delivery stakeholder checklist. So we had this checklist and I don't think it was ever implemented. They're going off of something totally different. And then I looked at the one that Max and that group came up with. And I think when we met with one of the reviewers, they weren't even aware of that checklist. So and we want to make sure that I think the main purpose of this is to make sure that all the effort that has been put in by these other, you know, 4 committees and hours of time can move forward and get incorporated moving forward. So, and it's a challenge right now. I think there's a lot of the remote environment has been challenging, new staff, the amount of turnover, you know, having, you know, Ollie, when he left, he had a lot of institutional knowledge. He was here for quite a few years. So again, you know, Jennifer's gaining that knowledge and trying to make sure that the community here, we can help support her and help bring some of this stuff back up so we don't have to redo it. You know, let's go back and review it. And I do have a ton of information.
So if you would like some, feel free to reach out, and I'll get you copies of any checklists that I have in my file, with probably my notes on it, but I do have quite a bit of information, so.
Great, thanks, Eric. Sounds like, oh, Jennifer, sorry.
Yeah, no, I just kind of wanted to respond maybe a little bit to some of the questions that were asked and just give, I guess, staff perspective on some of these things. I guess a lot of it was mentioned about consistency, and I think that that was the first thing that we were are trying to do is get everything under one reviewer with DE. So, and that's been like, I think for 3 months now. So again, just a little bit more time to kind of be able to get a little more time under our belt to just provide that consistency that you're looking for. The other thing, Byron, you had mentioned this specifically just to touch on the calves, and I want to make sure you know that I'm not looking at things in a vacuum when things come up. Others have had issues with these calves, and that's why I kind of looked into it more, looked into what WashDOT was, their design criteria for calves and what they had published, talking to Miles Lawson with our public health department who kind of regulates the wells and things like that. And he actually also talked to Ecology about this. So again, you know, looking at these things as they come up, because this has been ever evolving, like, you know, since 2015 when the new manual came out, and we kind of all had to learn something new at that point to kind of understand, well, what is Ecology looking for now on these rural tax lots? I mean, they're treating everything the same under 1 through 9 now, and we can't just look at things differently now like we used to. So it has been ever evolving. So again, I just want to say, yeah, I'm not making decisions in the vacuum as it comes to like when new things come up and we realize, hey, we might have been looking at this wrong all along and we need to step back and maybe look at it again and talk to others to see what we really should be requiring. I think some of the things that can help us maybe do more streamlined reviews and not go through so many review iterations as help from you guys to maybe getting complete submittals that don't have contradicting information, and then the plans say one thing but the TIR says another. Ignoring critical areas. I mean, you kind of mentioned this, that, you know, you're only doing the stormwater design, but if you have a wetland on the site or your septic design has to change, then your stormwater design is going to have to change. So we may be asking for those things, and we want to see water wells on the plans. We want to see septic systems on the plans, because those are going to affect your stormwater design. So it might seem that we're asking for too much on the plans, but there's a reason why we're asking for those things on the plans. The TIR and the plans are permitting documents that are required by the state. They're not just, you know, documents that we're asking for so we can feel good, you know, and just ask for them because we're asking for them. So I'm trying to see. Another thing, like I said, like incomplete submittals, contradicting information. And then when you do get review comments, make sure you're, you know, addressing all those comments. And if you do have questions, please reach out to us, the reviewer, or even myself. I'm more than happy to answer any questions. If there's like a design issue or maybe you disagree with what the reviewer said, I'm more than happy to always answer questions by email, by phone. I'm always available. So also, I think before COVID, we did have in-person first review meetings, and that might be something that we could start off again, or at least if you get your first review comments back and you feel like you need, you have a lot of questions, again, we could schedule a meeting so we can go over all those comments to make sure the second submittal addresses all those, and we can get you through and your permit approved and, you know, less review cycles. Because, and I forgot, I think Byron said this, staff's looking for a reason to say no rather than yes. And no, I promise you, we want to say yes, we do. And I love it when I see some plans and a TIR that match and everything is great, because I can say, yes, check, this looks good. I can sign my name and say this is approved. But when I get a set of plans and I have questions, that's where I kind of scratch my head and say, well, if this is wrong, what else is wrong? So again, I think that is it. But I agree with Kelly and maybe cleaning up the checklist a little, just going through and seeing, you know, is there, you know, some things that we don't necessarily need? Yes, maybe there are some, but then also publishing those. I agree that they should be published. I think I went and did these checklists back in 2018 with the intent that they were going to be published. So, yeah, I think that's it for me.
Do we have a copy of the one you guys are using? Okay.
Mike, yeah, Jamie. Max has his hand up.
Very good. Thanks for letting me know. Max, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you very much. Jennifer captured all that pretty well. I was just going to kind of comment in general. One of the outworkings, I think, or one of the balls that we started rolling when Eric and I worked on this last, was the idea of getting all of these reviews into development engineering and out of the permit center. And correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like I heard, generally speaking, I took some notes here, everyone seems to be pretty pleased with that. They're happy that they can get a hold of somebody in development engineering and ask questions and get a quick answer, a quick email or phone call. And it is generating at least a step in the right direction for consistency. And so I think we had some struggles with that in the permit center because different people reviewing different things. You also had people reviewing things that were not engineers. And so, you know, some obvious struggles that come with some of that. And so my recommendation is the same as April's, is that it sounds like we're heading in a good direction and we can maybe update some checklists, but that maybe we should let a few more of these things work out now that we've kind of got all the reviews, both 1 through 5s and 1 through 9s, being done by the same person who's in-house. And maybe the first step, if you want to talk about a subcommittee, is the engineers who do this kind of work regularly and our staff who's reviewing this stuff regularly, just getting together and going over, hey, here's what I check on a review. Here's the checklist I'm working from, and just kind of put it on the table so that everybody has a good idea and just see, because it seems to me that things are going in a good direction. And if the engineers who are submitting these and the engineer who's reviewing these can just come together and not even reinvent the wheel, but just, you know, kind of share some notes and say, here's what I'm looking at. Here's what I'm working on. It sounds like we're going in a good direction. So I don't know if that makes sense or not, but that's kind of my 2 cents on it for right now.
Great. Thanks, Max. Yeah, go for it. Mm-hmm.
My thoughts when Jennifer was speaking, I know that that we worked with the BIA a lot on getting, and I'm just going off what she says, getting better submittals and how that will actually make the process faster, because then we're spending less time reviewing because the submittals are better. And we ran into that even right when I started. We had an energy code going in right when I started, and our submittals were not very good. They were trying to get them in by a timeline. And we worked really hard this year, and I would say, and I even taught a couple of classes on how to make a correct plot plan and some tools, and it has helped tremendously with the items that are coming in. And then the process is faster because the submittals are better. So I don't know if we need, you know, some stormwater, how to get a good submittal in classes. That's what we did in BIA, and it worked.
Great, all great ideas. It sounds like moving forward that staff will take a look at and take a look at all the comments that they've gotten and see where they can go. And then does it seem appropriate then to come back at next month's meeting to get an update on that? Would that be too soon?
Maybe that's a little too soon.
Okay.
Maybe a month or two.
Yeah,
like two months at least.
This September, October, tentatively, October, to come back and give us an update.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Great, thank you, everyone. Before I turn the meeting back over to the regular chair, I just wanted to check to see who else online, who other D members online may have chimed in or gotten online while people were talking. I know that Jamie's on, but is there anybody else from Deeb that's online right now besides Terry and Nick and Dan? Right, I think that's it. Okay.
Before we move on, we had a question for Jamie, and he just stepped back in, but on the interim ordinance for the multifamily and landscaping standard, apparently something called a referendum was filed by one of the parties of record. Are you familiar with that process, Jamie?
I am not familiar with the process. But I could look into it and maybe get back to the D members.
Yeah. Is Leanne still on?
I think Leanne probably clicked
off. Yeah,
she's
probably long gone. I've never heard of it before, and I don't even know. I've never seen it in code. I've never heard of it.
And April said that she and staff are looking into it too, so she'll get back to us as soon as she gets some clarification as far as what's taking place and what it all means to everything.
So part of the charter, there's a new process for the public to get a referendum, on a past ordinance that the council does. And obviously we had a lot of testimony at that hearing, unfortunately. So I think they were there for another matter, but ended up testifying against the ordinance. But I can look into the procedures and get back to us.
Yeah, there was an article in the newspaper that may have brought people out too, and it was completely incorrect. It made it sound like this was a change in what we've been doing for the last 20 years.
It was, and that's
a clarification of
that's of how I why I geared my testimony the way I did.
Yeah.
Hopefully, making it clear, concise, and succinct that this is nothing new. This is just codifying what has been taking place over the last 20 years.
And the council is very clear on their deliberations to reiterate what Mike had just said, that this was just a clarification for how the council or the county has processed stuff over the last decades.
Okay, well, I'm going to turn this back over to you.
Okay. The next item on the agenda is number 4, community development staffing update and challenges, and we'll turn that over to April for some feedback, please.
So I wasn't here last week, and I heard that this is when this came up, so I don't exactly know what kind of feedback. I mean, we do have openings, we haven't held back on posting those openings. You know, it's not like we're holding up any of the openings. So we've got them posted. I've been a little more aggressive in the tactics to recruit than we've had to be in the past.
So I guess, April, can you speculate on how many openings there are in community development at this point? I think one of the concerns that I had heard last month in particular is that the applications and the whole process is kind of stretching out further and further and further, and the response that we've been getting is that there just isn't enough county staff, and that seems to be thematically what we've heard now for several years. And so is there a different way that the county can approach this, or is there a way that the public sector, private sector can help the county here in recruiting efforts, or I guess that's
I think
the questions we have.
I think community development, it has about 7 openings. Candidate pool, for the most part, can be good. The candidate pool has been good for our OA open positions. It's more difficult for engineers. And I will take any ideas on how to recruit better for engineers, because we're trying
so
to reach out to schools. It's civil engineers too, which is a hard one for us. So, I'll take feedback. OAs have been good. A lot of issues we've had too is where we will go through the process, and when we go to make the offer that they've already had another offer by that time. So that's also something else that we're facing. But it's the more skilled workers is where we're having application issues.
Is there something in the recruit?
Go ahead, Mike.
Sorry, Jamie. I was just curious if there's anything in the process, the hiring process, because it seems to take an awfully long time. And are you mandated, or are your hands tied by current policy or the state or the county? What is it that's holding you back from saying, this person's awesome, send them a letter out tomorrow?
Yes. So I think that there are ways that we can make it faster. We do have to have it posted for a certain amount of time. And then the way we interview is we create panels. And so getting everybody at the right time and getting that together, that can be something that pushes the time frame out. And we do need to look at those things because we are losing people by the time we offer, and it's because they've already taken another job. If we could get them faster, that would probably help. Yeah. But I wouldn't say, I mean, I would say we have the most, I think we have 7, which is not dire to me.
Good. Sorry, Jamie. Go ahead.
The permit center is probably getting hit the hard.
Yeah, the permit center. Okay. The questions I've got is, in sort of these where the applicant is declining county job, I guess what are the 3 big reasons? Obviously speed, I'm hearing, is one of them. Is it, you know, are the salaries not commensurate with what other jurisdictions are offering? Because I know, like, City of Hillsborough, for instance, seems to be hiring everybody under the sun from a lot of jurisdictions. What kind of other feedback are you guys getting in that regard?
Yes, pay is a factor.
And that's something you can't do anything about?
Correct.
It's above your pay grade.
Correct. And I'm okay with that.
Whose pay grade is that? Is that the county manager?
It's probably more budgetary.
This is Nick with Clark Public Utilities. We kind of see the same thing when we go out for an engineering position. It's our openings are staying open much longer than we typically do. Couldn't tell you why, honestly.
I think something else we're trying to implement within the county, or at least within community development, is where can we, like, when, for me, in the permit center, it was get an OA that's going to be your next permit tech, that's going to be your next permit, that's going to be your next planner, you know, so that we're feeding our own pipeline. And that seems to be working. I think that's why we're not in a dire situation right now, because the turnover we've had in the permit center is because they have are going into building or land use.
You know, one thing that kind of ties into the stormwater thing we just talked about was trying to simplify the process so we can do more with less, instead of having to go through this detailed, you know, having 80 comments on a SFR, you go through this simple list that Max and I worked on. And the idea was twofold. One, it was for the consumer, and the other part was for the county. It was to make sure that they could do these reviews in a few hours instead of, you know, weeks, and making sure that you can do more with less, and if you only have staff to do a certain amount of things, what's more important? Is it spending a ton of time on an SFR versus making sure that something that has a lot more potential impact on the public, the resources are spent that way? So it really was looking at, you know, trying to pare that process down based on risk. And I think that's, you know, one solution. I think a lot of organizations have had to do that. And, you know, we have as well, trying to make sure we're spending our resources on the most necessary things. So.
Terry?
Yeah, I just want to say to April, I know, just acknowledge, understand having to get creative. And I guess if there's things that, if there's things that can be helpful that are supported by DEEB in regards to any streamlining of anything, you know, as far as like requests of counsel or things of that nature, or if it's related to compensation things, I know those are things that we would like to help with, you know, if we're informed. And I'd say the other side of it too is, if there is, you know, if there's a loss of position or things like that, I know a lot of times we are an information source to other people in the industry. And so if that's shared with us, hey, we're going to see a slowdown potentially here. We're going to try and make up for it, but we're going to see a slowdown here because we lost this person or that person. We're trying to make that hire, but it takes a period of time. I think that kind of transparency too can really help with understanding from the private sector and and just clear communication. I mean, it is what it is, and you can only work with the staff that you have, and you're trying to hire people. So it helps that you're communicating this to us so we can share that. But also just, we want to be able to be supportive and help. So that's all I had to say, guys.
Okay. Well, there's going to be a slowdown in the permit center and we're working on it.
Understood.
Okay. Anybody else, any comments or questions for April? Okay. With that, Mike, and I'm sorry, again, I apologize for being late, everybody. But Mike, hopefully we moved your shoreline exemption issue to the end of the agenda, and I'll let you kind of take it from here.
Thanks, Jamie. What I'm bringing to the board today and to staff is something that has come up on several occasions, and it's been one that I've meant to bring forward and just have basically forgotten until it's just come up just recently on a project in our office that another planner is working on. And this goes back a few years, and I don't know as if we, I think it's one of those things that we're like, okay, fine, just we're just going to do it and just to get through the process. Instead of fighting about it, because and the county may have already dug in their heels with this and may have already had interpretations from the PA's office as far as the shoreline interpretation is concerned. But this really relates to a requirement for any properties that are located within a shoreline district that want to perform a boundary line adjustment to also go through a shoreline exemption. And I've taken a look at the WACs, the RCWs, the definitions, and I'm, you know, I've been doing this a couple decades and pretty understand, you know, applicability and where the nexus is, excuse me. Where a nexus is with a certain requirement requiring something else, and I'm just having some difficulty understanding how the county could require a shoreline exemption with a boundary line adjustment. And this isn't something that we need to go into really in depth today, but is maybe more of informational for April and Ted to kind of take a look at this. And I know that if you were to go to some of your new planning staff, that this is currently a discussion that's taking place with one of our other with one of our planners, and what I'm struggling with is that number one, the Shoreline Master Program does not specifically indicate anything in here with regards to land division. It's specific to development and specifically substantial development. And when you take a look at the RCW definition of development, it means a use of consisting of the construction or exterior alteration of structures, dredging, drilling, dumping, filling, removal of any sand, gravel, or minerals, bulkheading, driving of piling, placing of obstructions, or any project of a permanent or temporary nature which interferes with the normal public use of the surface of the waters overlying land subject to this chapter at any state of water level. Also taking a look at the definition of substantial development, which is usually the trigger for requiring a shoreline substantial development permit or a shoreline variance or a shoreline a conditional use permit or even an exemption, where substantial development means any development of which the total cost or fair market value exceeds $5,718 or is adjusted by the state OFM, or any development which materially interferes with the normal public use of the water or shorelines of the state except is specifically exempted pursuant to RCW 9058.03.03E and WAC 173.27.040. And so I know that there's been some justification for requiring a shoreline exemption for a boundary line adjustment, but it doesn't fall within, and it falls within a use category that doesn't apply to the current situation. And I don't remember the exact use, and I think it may have been bulkheading or something like that. Brent, maybe you know more about this being on the environmental end of things, but I'd really, you know, there's one thing in here. So as far as the residential uses in the use section is concerned, it just says residential uses, residential lots that are boundary line adjusted or newly created through a land division shall be configured such that structural flood hazard reduction measures are not required and will not be necessary during the life of the development or use. Shoreline stabilization measures are not required, and any loss of shoreline ecological function can be avoided. But I'm still struggling to where we need to go through a shoreline exemption for boundary line adjustment, because, and here's the kicker, if we go through a shoreline exemption for a boundary line adjustment, first of all, why? I mean, what is it that we're looking to accomplish in that regard? And two, if the owner was to develop anything on the property, for instance, a shed or another house on an adjusted lot, they would still have to go through an exemption if they can meet the setback, a variance if they can't meet the setback, or any of the other associated uses that would require substantial development permit or conditional use permit. So it's the moving of property lines and the requirement for shoreline exemption that I need and the development community needs to understand from the county side so that we're able to better explain why we have to go through a process when we don't even understand why we need to go through the process itself.
So I can speak to that. I think that, I mean, the county's interpretation historically has been there are criteria for, and well, first of all, based on the interpretation, the shoreline exemption should only be applied for residential boundary line adjustments, adjustments on residential lots, because the criteria are only in the residential use section. Those are the criteria that you referenced. I think the county's interpretation historically has been there are approval criteria in the Shoreline Master Program, and the only way we can verify that those criteria have been met is to do a review. The criteria about the flood hazard area and the bulkhead, those are really straightforward, because if you're not in the flood hazard area, there's no flood hazard area on the property, and you're not doing anything, you know, in or near the ordinary high water mark, there's not going to be any bulkheading issues. What does come up is the shoreline ecological function, because a boundary line adjustment can create a situation where a property that could conform to the setbacks is now in need of, in the future, maybe in need of a variance because of the nature of the adjustment. Now, I recognize that majority of adjustments don't create this issue, but essentially when it does, the property owner that's affected, whether it's the owner that is involved in the adjustment or a future owner, may not be able to get their variance because it is essentially a self-created scenario, because the boundary line adjustment was a voluntary process. I think we might have an opportunity to potentially streamline reviews for boundary line adjustments, because the code, really all it says for a shoreline exemption is that that we have to issue a statement of exemption. The process that we've developed and the fee that's associated with it is really trying to, you know, fit the vast majority of those types of activities. I certainly think we could tailor something to a boundary line adjustment that could be a lot more streamlined, unless it gets into that critical area issue, perhaps. The other thing, the language is somewhat confusing, and it's the language that we get from ecology, because while it talks about substantial development, there, it also refers to uses. I can run this down for you. I've done the analysis before. I just need to refer back to it, and I can give you the code references where that comes from. The other aspect is if we can all conclude that our use standards that specifically reference boundary line adjustments are not coming from the WAC or RCW, that is something that we could look at in a future shoreline amendment. Unfortunately, amending the shoreline master program is not something that can be done with a biannual code. It's a very specific process. In addition to that, another unique aspect of the shoreline master program is even if April and I make a interpretation and a management decision, we have to run that past ecology. And ecology gets the final say as to whether or not that interpretation is appropriate. We can look at that as well. We have gone through that process in the past. I think next steps from my perspective for me to go back and revisit when this question has come up before and get the analysis to you, and then maybe we can get together and have a discussion about it. And then see if there's somewhere we can go from there. And I can also talk to Ted and Brian, who does the bulk of the shoreline reviews, about what we might be able to do to streamline the process. The challenge is if we have to create a new fee, that has to go to council. But if we can find a way to work within the existing structure, maybe we can at least make sure we're waiving habitat fees when they're not appropriate, if that isn't occurring already. Because that does add a significant expense to that process.
Okay, yeah, that was kind of where I was, I know that this has been the policy. I would be very interested in an understanding as to how you arrived at what the current policy is regarding requirement for shoreline exemption with the boundary line adjustment. I'm still challenged with, and that maybe that will then help me understand how you've addressed use and development with something that is a lot line adjustment, and how you've somehow dovetailed those three things together: development, use, and what is essentially a lot line adjustment. You don't have to respond now. I mean, you can get that back to me. But I know. But that is the other thing, is that even though we went through the process 8 years ago, 6 years ago, whatever it was, to streamline the shoreline exemption process, which really did help, because we were essentially doing a complete shoreline substantial development permit application for an exemption at the time. But there's still a 4 or 5 page thing to fill out. And then there's the drawings. And you have a site plan, you have to cut sections, and for development, for new development, that makes sense to establish the, what the elevation of the new home would be, how high the home would be, where is it in relationship to the shoreline setback, where is it in relation to the riparian habitat conservation zone. We understand that. But when you're talking about a lot line adjustment and all they're doing is taking a line and doing this, do we have to now cut sections through all the existing properties or existing homes? And then what is it, you know, and then there's kind of the whole, well, do we have to then show that it was in compliance before and now isn't, or whatever it might be? So, yeah, if you could, I don't want to get into a big, long discussion about it today. I just want to first understand how the county has justified the nexus to requiring a shoreline exemption with a boundary line adjustment for any properties that are within the shoreline jurisdiction. And if you've already gone to ecology and ecology has come back and said, yes, absolutely, end of conversation. There's nothing you can do about it. But if it's been your interpretation or the county's interpretation of the Shoreline Master Program based on whoever was interpreting it at the time, maybe it's time to revisit it. So is that something we can come back to next month or in a couple of months? Or?
Well, I think we
can. Mike, I was going to suggest, can we revisit that in a couple months and give Brennan and his team some time to run that down?
Would that work?
Certainly, but I think we can start the dialogue in between.
Perfect.
Between yourself, you and myself, and then we can, you know, send it around to the to the board as needed.
And then maybe if it works out, then I'll just come back to Deeb with an update next month. And if not, we'll push it on to the month following. Okay. Great. Thanks, Brent. Appreciate it.
Okay. Anything else on that matter?
No, not for me.
Hearing none, moving on to public comment. Is there any public comment out there? Seeing none in the room, seeing none online. So I know the next meeting is scheduled for the Thursday right before Labor Day, September 1st. Unfortunately, I will not be there. I'll be on the Salmon River, but hopefully, I just want to do a quick check with the D members that are present. Will everybody else be available that day?
I'll be here.
Yeah, I'll be here. I'll be out.
I'm a maybe.
Okay, maybe I'll send. I know Jeff Briston will be gone as well because he will be with me.
Yeah, why don't you just send out an email? If we can get a quorum, that'll be there. Great. If not, we can push it till next week.
Okay, that sounds like a plan. I will send that out here this afternoon. And with that, other than that, we are adjourned for this month. Thank you, everybody.